Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, and your chief investigator of images. It has been a very exciting week for The Art Detective. We relaunched, and we're trying to do something a little bit different this time round. Instead of getting funding through ads, we want to try and bring you the content that you want ad-free, and we're trying to do that through our Patreon site. Now, many of you have already got on board with this. Thank you so much. It means so much to all of us. It means that we can keep bringing you the best quality art history podcasts. So we've also added a few things. For $1 a month, Patreon supporters will be able to join the Facebook community. We'll be uploading videos on there. So, for example, the talk that you're about to listen to is available as a video that you can watch. So you can get all of that for $1 a month. But also, we've introduced for $5 a month ad-free podcasts. This is our attempt to free you from the incessant sales that come with so many podcasts. Do consider joining us. You can do so by going to patreon.com/artdetective. Now, today's episode is incredibly exciting. I had the opportunity to interview Tracy Chevalier, the author of Girl with a Pearl Earring. That book made such an impact on me when it came out 20 years ago. So this was an anniversary experience. We were getting together to celebrate 20 years of Girl with a Pearl Earring. But what's so wonderful is Tracy's absolute endless enthusiasm for Vermeer, his art, his paintings. She brought those paintings to life in the most vivid way. And the book went on to inspire a film and went on to inspire lots of future art historians, myself included. But it's a chance for me to probe at the actual artist, at Vermeer himself, and to find out a bit more about how Tracy wrote such a best-selling, brilliant novel.
Celebration we are gathered together for tonight. 20th anniversary of this book. Now, behind the scenes, what you didn't see was that I did say to Tracy to meet her and to be in her company, my teenage self is screaming.
Aww.
I am honoured to be here on a stage with her today. This book made a massive impact on me, so much so that I am now an art historian.
Hurrah!
So, hurrah. It is powerful, and I'm sure people in the room feel this sense after 20 years of the impact it made then, and rereading it recently, the impact it still makes. If you have a passion for art, to read this book, it brings out that passion so thoroughly. Why did you write it 20 years ago?
Why did I write it? It's a good story, actually. I fell in love with Vermeer when I was 19. I visited my sister in her apartment in Boston, and she had a poster of the painting up on the wall. I had never seen it, and I just remember standing in front of it, walking straight over to it, standing and staring at it, and just absorbing her, that look. I always end up looking at it, you know, when I'm talking about it. the blue and the yellow, so gorgeous. The sculpted face, her liquid eyes. I wondered. I just thought she was beautiful, and I wondered what she was thinking. And the next day, I went out and got a poster for myself, and I had that poster. I still have that poster many, many years later. And I kept it. I took it with me everywhere I went. I eventually ended up in England, and it always was on a wall somewhere where I lived. And years later, in 1997, so 1995, I saw it in the flesh. There was a very a Vermeer exhibition at the Moritz House in The Hague, and I saw her over the heads of a million people. So, you know, it was not the best viewing experience. But 18 months after that, in 1997, I was lying in bed one day, and I just was looking at her, and I suddenly thought, I wonder what Vermeer did to her to make her look like that. And it was the first time I'd ever thought that that look had anything to do with the painter. I always just thought, it's a girl. And now I suddenly thought, that's a reflection of a relationship.
Wow.
So what's the relationship? And it's such a powerful look. You really don't know if she's happy or sad or how old she is or anything. And in fact, Nina has some slides later, and one of them is of a girl, another girl Vermeer painted. And when you see them side by side, you just think, wow, this one is just so incredible. And so I looked it up. I got right out of bed. I looked up in my exhibition catalog and found out that we know nothing about her, who she is, and very little about Vermeer. And I thought, yes, so I can write whatever I want. And so I did. But not whatever I want.
No.
We do know a little bit about Vermeer, not a lot, but I tried to be as respectful of what we do know and of his paintings as I could.
I mean, I believe that this is the most voted the most popular painting in the Netherlands. It's got something there, hasn't it? And I think that what you're capturing in there is a relationship, but there is something in terms of its structure. It's different. It is Dutch Golden Age, but there's an intimacy. It is like a Mona Lisa of the North, isn't it?
Yes, that's what they call it.
Yeah.
And I think in a way it's better than the Mona Lisa because you can see it better. I think that we've just been so blinded by the Mona Lisa for many years, and it's also quite a withdrawn painting, the Mona Lisa, and this is really in your face, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it's also brighter. It's literally brighter than the Mona Lisa. And sadly you also can't see the Mona Lisa very well. In the Louvre, it's just an incredible zoo to try to get anywhere near her.
Yeah.
And there's a barrier, and there's just flash guns off
Doss
going
in the
off.
Background,
and,
is it true?
And whereas if you go on a quiet November Tuesday, a rainy Tuesday in November, to the Moritz House in The Hague, you can be with her on your own. And there's just a little, very tasteful, semicircular wooden barrier but you can still get that close. And she's really something. And I think what I really love about this painting is that there is no resolution, that you can look at it and look at it, and I've been looking at it for 30 years or however long, and I still don't really know what she's thinking. I still don't really know what her relationship with Vermeer is, even though I've written a whole book about it. And that, to me, is a masterpiece is one that you keep coming back to because you get something out of it each time you look at it.
And I was going to ask you if after 20 years you still loved her.
I do. I do still love her, luckily, because I get asked about her a lot. And also, there's images of her all through my study, and not just the old poster, but lots of stuff. So for tonight, because it's the 20th anniversary, there's so much merchandise, but tonight I've put on my Girl with a Pearl Earring socks.
Oh, my goodness. We are sharing photos of those later. She has an actual pearl earring.
Yeah, and there's a pearl on that side.
There's a sewn-in pearl, people. That is a stunning bit of merchandise.
I bet you're jealous, yes.
I am so jealous.
But you can get Girl with a Pearl Earring Miffy dolls and rubber ducks that are made in Girl with a Pearl. So it's a little insane. But, yes, you can get her everywhere, and she is everywhere.
The socks are driving me mad with jealousy. Let's have a little think about about why you picked Vermeer and who he is.
Okay.
I'm not reading all this out to you, friends. It's just something that if you get distracted, please read facts. But there are facts up here, like his birth date, where he was from. Vermeer, overlooked, essentially, for many centuries, for a good couple of centuries.
Till the mid-19th century. Yes.
Why him? Was there something about him that lured you in?
Yeah, I think it's not just Girl Le Perlering, but all of his paintings have a quality that draws you in, but also holds you back at the same time. And that push and pull, it really is appealing. And I find myself spending a lot of time in front of Vermeer paintings. And actually, if I stand in a room and watch the audience, people walking around, I notice that they spend more time in front of Vermeer's because there's something very mysterious about them, and there's a kind of holding back. He places particularly women on their own in a corner of one room. He paints the same room over and over again. We'll see that in a minute, and he puts stuff in front of them, tables and chairs and tablecloths, rugs. And keeps them apart from us. So it's almost like, and some of the paintings, there's a curtain that's almost pulled back, like it's a theatrical event, and the women are doing something so simple, like pouring milk or writing a letter, but he makes them into a kind of theater, but a very quiet theater. And you're held back from it. And he's upholding like domestic life as something that's very beautiful and mysterious. And I just love that about it.
And you set up a really interesting comparison in the book as well, because you've got the crucifixion room, you've got the idea that these are Catholics surrounded by centuries of religious art, which, you know, there is a sense in which there is a comparative of work, a body of work whereby religious artists compare and contrast. What Vermeer and the other Dutch artists are doing is a breakaway. It's saying, well, we won't use the saints, we won't use the Virgin and Christ. We'll look at domestic settings.
Everyday life.
A sanctity in some of those scenes, isn't there, I suppose?
Yeah. Well, I think in the 17th century Holland, the rise of the middle class was affected painting, and particularly because Holland had just come through this long war with Catholic Spain. So they moved away from Catholicism, and the Protestant ethic was not to have paintings in churches. And so there was less and less painting of religious subjects. And the middle classes could afford paintings, and they said, show us in those paintings. I want to see me. I want to buy something that has, you know, my household up on the wall. And so they went to, they started painting markets and taverns and maid sweeping. And that's what you see. And I think Vermeer just kind of cranked it up and took it to an nth degree. Now, we put this up here because when Nina sent me the PowerPoint slides, I said, that's nice, but that's not actually Vermeer. We know so little about Vermeer that we don't have a portrait of him. Yeah. So the one before is not actually of him. I think it's of Carol Fabricius, and who is a colleague, a peer. But the one portrait that might be of him is an early painting of his. This is called the Procurus, and it's a genre painting. And in Dutch painting, if you have somebody looking out, everybody else is looking somewhere else, but if they're looking out at you, that's often a self-portrait.
Yeah.
And so we think that the man on the left with the red hair and the hat and who's smiling might be the young Vermeer. I found it, I mean, I think that it probably is, but that's not how I imagine him somehow.
No. He looks sort of lurid and garish and a bit sort of rakish as well in this, doesn't he? Of all his paintings too, it's to me the most overt. There's a beautiful sort of serenity in some of his images. This doesn't. Yeah. To me, have it.
Well, I think he was still training.
Yeah.
And he...
Because this is 56, isn't it?
Yes. It's an early painting, and there was then a leap If you take the next slide, we can talk. There's a change. Ah, yes. Okay. So we've gone off onto, he did do two landscapes. These are the landscapes, the View of Delft and a Little Street. Both of them, View of Delft is in The Hague, right across from Girl with Pearl Earring in the same room. It's such a wonderful room to stand in. This is the room that, this is the painting that Proust wrote about, the little yellow, Albertine goes in front of it and swoons. And The Little Street is at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. And but he takes, there comes a point when his early stuff, he moves away and something changes, something focuses and turns. If you take the next slide, that'll probably give us a better example.
It's those two rooms, isn't it? Yeah. It's the interiority. He's gone inside.
Something happens. And one theory is that he learned to use a camera obscura. Now, he was probably friends with Anthony van Leeuwenhoek. Yes, there you go. Anthony van Leeuwenhoek was the executor of Vermeer's will, and so they must have known each other in some form or another. They lived right around the corner. It's likely they were friends. And van Leeuwenhoek invented the microscope, and he had lots. He also had a camera obscura. And a camera obscura, when you look through it, it you use it in a darkened room and it with one point of light, and it it intensifies the colors. It blurs some things, it brings other things into focus. And the theory is that Vermeer used it to look, either look, so there are some theories that he actually painted using it at the same time, which I find hard to imagine, but I could imagine him looking.
For inspiration. And he probably borrowed it rather than owned it, didn't he? There's sort of debates about whether he actually owned a camera.
Well,
yeah.
We know very little about him, but what we do know is when he died at the age of 43, when he had either a stroke or heart attack brought on by stress, because he was in debt. The will is still in the archives, and attached to the will, he was in debt, and so his executors went around the house and listed all the contents of his house to figure out how to pay off some of these debts. And they listed every saucer and pot and wife's clothes. And if he had had a camera obscura, it would have been listed, so I don't think he did.
But the idea that this technology is out there, the idea of photorealism coming through in his brushwork as well, the idea that, you know, we're just on the brink of photographic realism, but he's trying to give that to his patrons. He's saying, this is an image of your wife. This is an image of the woman you lust after. Mm. And it could step out of the panel at you. That's really where the power of this sort of very realistic art comes from, isn't it?
Yeah. And here, as I was saying before, if you look at the one on the right, the curtain has the effect of making this into a tableau that we're not actually party to, but we're getting to have a peek at. So there's also this feeling of privileging the viewer to be able to see something that we're maybe not meant to see. One of the reasons I love this painting on the right so much is that it's possibly the only other portrait we have of Vermeer. He's got his back to us.
Yeah.
It's perfect. And he's wearing red stockings. I'm not sure if it comes
out.
There
he is,
it's
just
cut
at the bottom.
Yes, but
I've
he's wearing red stockings, and I just think that it looks very jolly there.
I like
very
his
beautiful
top, all this is slashed.
Yes,
look going
they
on.
Often used to wear kind of costumes to paint it, or they paint people in costumes. So that's the Girl with the Pearl Earring, the turban that she's wearing is not what women wore at the time.
Yeah.
It was to make her into a kind of historic figure.
But the domesticity is, in a way, a way of getting into the real Delft, the real place. So Milkmaid, I suppose, is a better representation of that. When we saw the landscapes, when we saw this setting, what comes through to me so strongly in your book is that you are taking us around this place, you are walking us through. And what was it about that place at that time that made you want to write a book about it?
Well, it was the painting that came first, and I inherited the period, but it suited me really well. I felt that when I went to Delft, I thought it's a compact city. It's a series of canals and bridges, and it's quite carefully laid out. And so is society. It was very The Dutch feeling at the time was one of house being house proud, and of scrubbing the front stoop every morning.
Yes,
you slosh water out and scrub it, and that was what every housewife did or every maid did to make the front stoop. And that just I could really feel that. And this view of Delft, I just particularly love it with those two women talking down there. Yeah. And I think if you took them away, it just wouldn't be the same.
It wouldn't have the power.
And he knew. He just knew that it needed to have two people connecting and gossiping there.
But likewise, in Little Street, it's the people that bring that to life. It's,
yes.
Yeah, what you want to do is go into those scenes, go in further, discover the household. So
yeah.
It's almost a precursor, an album cover for The Inner Sleep.
And I want to see what those two kids are doing.
Yeah.
The ones who are... On the curb there, they must be playing some sort of game. But
like the children you write about in the book, you know, you've thought those characters out of these artworks as well.
And one of what was so great about making this book was that I had to do a lot of research, and I read a lot, and I went to Holland, but I went to Delft, but I also just looked at a lot of paintings. And so if I was thinking about children playing outside, I would just study that painting very carefully, and then I'd look for a whole bunch of other Dutch paintings of children playing. Or if Greet, the girl, has to go to the market, the meat market, I'd start looking at paintings of meat markets, and there were plenty. So, or the interiors of houses and how the kitchen was set up and all of that. It's really well documented, given that it's not, there's no photography at that time. It was pretty photographic, and that was what I found so helpful, and it just eased my way into the whole scene.
Well, it's often what I say about being an art historian is that artworks are witnesses. If they could talk to you, they were there, they saw it, and we're the ones that have to listen to them. And so, I mean, in these images, the reason I think I wanted to show these was that you've got this space, and it's the space that you set a lot of the drama of the book within. These two rooms that he sets almost all of them in, really, at his high point, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Vermeer lived with his mother-in-law, the whole family did, and they eventually had 11 children, and four more who died, so it was a huge household. And Vermeer, as far as we can work out, had a room on the first floor, north-facing, because you want north light if you're an artist, and it was almost always the light coming from the left.
Yeah.
And that, so that corner was painted over and over again. So the same room, same window. He'd change the window panes. Sometimes he would change the floor a bit, but it was the same setup over and over. And actually quite a lot of the same people and the same clothes. So if you see the woman playing on the left with the yellow and black bodice and the ribbons in her hair, she's wearing the same yellow and black bodice. Now, it could be the same woman, but it also could be a different woman. I've seen other women wearing that bodice, and that was one of the clues. I had very few clues to go on when I was making up the story, but one of them was that we saw in the codicil that was attached to Vermeer's will all of the clothes listed that his wife Katharina owned, and one was a blue house coat, one was a yellow and white ermine-trimmed coat, and one was a yellow and black bodice. And so we know that different women wore them. We know that his models wore his wife's clothes, whether it was his wife or not. It was other women too. And that's what made me think when I looked at the painting of Girl with a Pearl Earring, I thought she's really young. I think that she knows him well, but I don't think that she's his daughter. Because that's one of the ideas is that, and we'll get to that when we get to the other two paintings. But I think that she knows him, so maybe she lives in the household. Maybe she's his servant. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, okay, how did Vermeer paint these calm paintings when he had 11 children and a lot of servants? And I only had one kid when I was pregnant when I was writing it, but I knew what kids were like. I knew that it would be busy, a busy household. So how did he do it? He must have compartmentalized. So he had his studio on the first floor, and I think he probably said, nobody comes in here, not the wife, not the kids. The maid can come in here to clean, but that's it.
Right.
And so that gets her into the room. Nice. And then when he sees her, he wants to paint her. And he has her wear, she's wearing very plain clothes, a strange turban-y thing, but it's not like it's velvet or fur or satin, which some of these women are wearing. It's very plain. And that pearl earring, there's no way it could have been hers if she's his servant. So whose is it? And I thought, it's got to be Katerina's, his wife. And we also know that he painted slowly, very, very carefully. We only know of 35 or 36 paintings that he did. Not very many, very, you know, small output. And if he painted slowly, pretty girl in the room with him on her own for months, painting this painting, and wearing his wife's earring, then, you know, you put that all together, then there's the story right there.
But what I think you did well is you didn't go down the rabbit hole of, oh, well, they're instantly having a crazed love affair.
No.
As other people who've written about this artist and model relationship have been tempted to do, there's a restraint there, and the restraint, in a way, adds a flesh to the characters that is more intriguing. The fact that there's a tension, but it's also almost a celebration or a recognition on Vermeer's part of what she can do. She can mix up paints. She can. She brings something to the process, doesn't she?
I definitely didn't want this to be your standard love affair.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be a meeting of aesthetic minds. Yeah. And I took my cue from Vermeer himself, because I think the way he paints women is reverential, and there's also a real sense of less is more. So in the book, they only touch twice, and that, you know, once on the hand and once on the ear, and that's not very much. And yet people have said to me, this is an incredibly sexy or sensual book, and that's because of the restraint and the incredible power of restraint, and I've sort of lived by less is more ever since. And in fact, when I started writing the or researching the book, I found out I was pregnant, and so I only had 8 months really to research and write it. I wanted to get it done before the baby came. And that's insanely crazy fast to do anything.
8 months from start to finish.
But what it meant was, I said, okay, it's going to be short. It's going to be from one point of view. It's going to be nothing tricksy. It's going to be linear telling. And I'm going to do less is more, because that's what Vermeer's paintings are like. So I'm going to do really spare prose. And I'm so glad that I went down that route, because I just learned a lot from him about how to tell a story in a simple and stripped down way.
Yeah, I think that's certainly what comes across. And even the way that there is a temptation to fill the streets of Delft in the Golden Age full of a Bruegel-like, with just loads of characters and loads of noise. But again, the characters are quite minimal, and you can see the development in each one. And with Greet in particular, you know, there is a sense in which she's changed by her exposure to him, even being warned about being with him. Is that something you think would have happened between models and artists at the time?
Yes, I think I'm sure it probably happened. Mm. Because if you look at other paintings, not Vermeer paintings, but if you look at lots of the genre paintings of people in taverns, and there's a lot of rollicking sexual activity, so to speak. And I could easily imagine that spilling over into more rollicking painting sessions, and so I think that it certainly could have happened, but I just decided to go a different route with him. It was the sense I got from his paintings, and because we know so little about him, the only information we have about him is in the archives. So his will, the times he got into debt, when he got married, his children, baptism records. But other than that, there's nothing. There's no There's no drawings by him, and there's no letters to him or from him, nothing. So we just have to look at his character from what comes out in the paintings.
One of the interesting things, actually, that I did want to ask you about was this idea of patronage, because you make an interesting twist, if you like, on who the salacious one is in the relationship here. That, because at the beginning you said, you know, what you realized when you were looking at it is she's looking at Vermeer. But she's also looking at you, at me, and at the patron who's ordered the picture, hasn't it?
Yes, and the patron, Van Ryven, was Vermeer's painter. And in the end, he had more paintings than anyone else. And when after he died, he left them to his daughter and son-in-law. And when the daughter died, I think the son-in-law, there was an auction in 1696. And that's how we sort of know more or less how many paintings there are, what paintings there are. And so Van Ryven was a very important person in Vermeer's life, because he would have provided him with, you know, he would have paid for the paintings, so that was what kept them going. But he didn't paint very fast, so he was always a little bit in debt. Not always, but he got into debt.
And but he wanted it to look, so we could assume, couldn't we, as indeed I think you've done brilliantly in the book, that she has to look inviting, she has to look alluring for the patron.
Yeah.
But it, actually what you're saying is, of course, the time spent painting it would be Vermeer that she was looking at.
Yes. She's not looking at the patron. She's not going to know. And actually, it's a good point to look at these two. Okay, so we have a pretty poorly pixelated left-hand one, and that's like, it's almost like we're not even giving her a chance.
We're not even giving her a chance to stand up. Yeah.
But these two were painted around the same time. I think the one on the left is painted a little later, but only a year or two later. And I suspect that the left one is his daughter. And when you look at them, the big difference, two big differences, one is that she's got her mouth open on the right and not on the left. And that was what made me think that in Dutch painting at the time, if you had your mouth open, that was somewhat of a sexual invitation. And I couldn't imagine Vermeer would ever do that with his daughter. He would have her tight-lipped and smiling somewhat insipidly, as she does on the left.
Yeah, sweet and innocent. There's complete innocence there.
Yeah.
And then that's what's changed.
The other thing is the angle of the angle of the face, and that's really important, because the girl on the left, you can see her, you can really tell what the shape of her face is like and what she looks like. Pearl earring, and you can see her hair, and you see how far back her hair, forehead goes and stuff. On the right, the girl is turned in such a way that you can't quite see the shape of her face. Her nose is blending into her cheek. You can't even really see what the nose line is. And it's hard to tell what her hair is covered up. You have no idea what color it is. I have a hard time telling what color her eyes are. And it's much more mysterious. And it also looks almost like she's just turned her head and is looking at you. And this one, she looks much more on the left, like much more like she's posing. She's doing this dutifully for her father, whereas this one has much more mystery to her.
To me, it's kind of the comparison of, you know, my daughter's school photo and then my daughter posing on a night out, like, I'm going out. There's a definite knowingness in girls posing.
Yes.
But at the same time, that knowingness is balanced with innocence, and that's what makes it such a difficult contrast. Exactly. I think you're right about the lips, and I have to, of course, bring us onto the lustrous lips of Scarlett Johansson, who plays it so beautifully. There is that sequence where she is being asked to lick her lips in the book and again in the film. And that is, I mean, I found that, given that the two characters only touch very briefly like this once, that was incredibly intense, actually. Yeah. And so were you trying to get to the heart of the painting's suggestiveness then with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I remember in the film, instead of licking her lips the way we would normally lick our lips, like, you know, that's what you do, she goes...
She goes
like that, and it's much more...
There's no tongue.
No, there's no tongue, no. It's much more unusual and surprising and studied in a way, and I thought that was very clever. But
And can I ask you about the film? Did you get involved? Did you...
I had a great relationship with the film, because I was a beginner. I was a novice, so they didn't really want me to have anything to do with writing it. They had a screenwriter, scriptwriter, but I met with a scriptwriter once or twice to answer some questions, and they let me read the first draft of the screenplay out of courtesy. And I knew it was out of courtesy. And that was fine with me because I thought, I don't know how to make a film. And so I thought, I read it and I thought, I'm going to choose my battles here, which is always a very good philosophy. And I made a couple of comments and she answered them, and that was fine. And then I just let them get on with it. But I had a good relationship with the producers, and they had me come on the set to watch. And I went twice because I had so much fun. It was just, I'd never seen a film being made. I didn't realize that there'd be, you know, when you see two people talking on the screen, there's out of the sight lines, there's about 30 people with clipboards and boom mics and all this stuff. And then they say cut, and they come running up and powder their faces and move their hair around, and I just loved it. I had a blast watching it, and I feel very lucky because the producer was very passionate about the book, and the director is very passionate about Dutch painting, and so it looked really beautiful. He referenced a lot of paintings, different paintings.
The cinematography was unbelievable. Yeah, it was beautiful. I was watching it back the other night, and you know, it could take each still frame, and it could be a Vermeer, it could be a Dutch Gold.
Yeah, it could
painting.
Be Rembrandt. It could
be a Rembrandt.
Any, yeah,
and it's absolutely beautiful. And the color palette, and also the casting. I thought they were incredibly well cast. And actually, for a film version of a book, I thought very faithful. They've stuck to a lot of your
I think subject. What they had to do, which was what most films unfortunately have to do, is cut out the subtleties of the subplots.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to give more room for these two to be together.
Yes.
It meant that the other characters never really came into their own. And they did in the screenplay, and they did in the filming. I saw scenes where they filmed wonderful long dialogues, scenes between the wife and the patron, and then they used like two lines of it.
Yeah.
And I understood why. I mean, the director said to me, we needed, you know, this can only really be about 100 minutes long, and we needed to give more space to Vermeer and Greet to develop their relationship. So that's how it goes. And I got that. And I think it was good that I was slightly arm's length, because it might have upset me more if I had been more intimately involved. But I wasn't. And so at the end, when I saw it, I was very happy with it.
Okay.
Because I felt that it, I always think of it as the film and the book are part of the same family. They're not exactly the same girl, but they're like sisters or cousins. So they're you recognize the influence.
Oh, that's a lovely way to think about it. And speaking of which, I want to hear you read from your best-selling, celebrating 20th anniversary book. And we've picked this scene to have up in the background because this is the extract you're going to be reading a bit from, isn't it?
Yes. So one of the things that I learned a lot from watching the film, and 20 years on, I am my own worst critic, so I know a lot of the things that bug me about this book. And when I saw them filming it, and when the film came out, I thought, ah, he pierced her ear. That's how they did it. I had this fiddly thing where she pierces her ear, and then when it comes time to paint, as you'll see, then he wants her to pierce the other ear, and she does it, and it's like, oh, Tracy, why didn't you learn? You know, I could have simplified this whole thing just by having him pierce the ear when she sits down, but he doesn't. So it's a little more complicated, but this scene isn't really complicated because it's kind of the climax of their relationship. And it's very short.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So he's been painting her for months, and he reached around to the cupboard behind him, picked up an earring, and held it out to me. "I want you to put it in," I said. I had not thought I could ever be so bold. Nor had he. He raised his eyebrows and opened his mouth to speak, but did not say anything. He stepped up to my chair. My jaw tightened, but I managed to hold my head steady. He reached over and gently touched my earlobe. I gasped as if I'd been holding my breath underwater. He rubbed the swollen lobe between his thumb and ear, then pulled it taut. With his other hand, he inserted the earring wire in the hole and pushed it through. A pain like fire jolted through me and brought tears to my eyes. He did not remove his hand. His fingers brushed against my neck and along my jaw. He traced the side of my face up to my cheek, then blotted the tears that spilled from my eyes with his thumb. He ran his thumb over my lower lip. I licked it and tasted salt. I closed my eyes again, then, and he removed his fingers. When I opened them again, he had gone back to his easel and taken up his palette. I sat in my chair and gazed at him over my shoulder. My ear was burning, the weight of the pearl pulling at the lobe. I could not think of anything but his fingers on my neck, his thumb on my lips. He looked at me but did not begin to paint. I wondered what he was thinking. Finally, he reached around him, behind him again. "You must wear the other one as well," he declared, picking up the second earring and holding it out to me. "Why? It can't be seen in the painting." "You must wear both," he insisted. "It is a farce to wear only one." "But my other ear is not pierced." "Then you must tend to it." He continued to hold it out. I reached over and took it. I did it for him. I got out my needle and clove oil and pierced my other ear. I did not cry or faint or make a sound. Then I sat all morning, and he painted the earring he could see. And I felt stinging like fire in my other ear, the pearl he could not see.
Wow. Wow. So less is more, is more, is more, is more. That was, yes, deeply sensual, deeply suggestive, but also really beautifully written, very emotive writing. I don't think it's hearing passages like that back that make me realise why we all fell in love with the book when we did 20 years ago and why we're all still so in love with it now. It is a masterpiece like the piece you've written about. And I'm just so grateful that you've come to talk to us all about it tonight. Thank you. And we're going to leave some time for questions. But for now, can we just all thank Tracy Chevalier?
Thank you.
Thank you. Beautiful reading.
So I'd be happy to answer questions, and I think if we bring the lights up a little bit, I'll be able to see you. So I think that we have, do we have microphones? I think we do. So if you have a question about anything, really, and it can be to Nina, too. It doesn't have to just be to me. Raise your hand, and we'll bring a microphone to you.
Oh, there's a hand.
Yes, there's a hand. Yeah. Hi there, and thanks for that. Just a quick question.
If you hold it up closer.
Like here? There we go. How did you choose her name?
How did I choose her name?
Yeah.
Good question. Another good story. I've been collecting them over the years. Two name stories. When I do research for the books, I research, I take notes. I don't use a computer. I don't use a laptop at the library or whatever. I write it in a notebook. And at the back of the page of the notebook, I have a names page. And I put family names and I put first names and last names. I make a list as I'm researching, just in case I need a name. So I was writing down all of these Dutch women's names, and I came across, I can't remember where it was, but I came across Greet, and I thought, that's what I want. Something short and simple. Greet. And it's short for Marguerite, but I just thought, Greet, that's perfect. So I chose that, and then a year after the book came out, I was at a reading, and somebody said to me, that was really smart choosing Greet. And I said, oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Why smart? And they said, well, you know, Marguerite. And I said, yes, it is short for Marguerite. And they said, yes, well, Margarita in Greek means pearl.
Wow.
And I was
like,
oh, yeah, of course, of course. Yes, thank you very much. And but I didn't. No, I should have known, and I didn't know. And so that was amazing. And then the other amazing story of names is that the painting we saw earlier of the woman pouring milk is the other, probably the other servant in Vermeer's household. And when I was doing, I named her, when I started writing it, I named her. One of the names in the back of my notebook was Annika, so I named her Annika. I thought, that's a good other servant name. And then when I found, I started reading this biography I hadn't meant to get, which was about all the people in Vermeer's life, and the only people they really know are the problems. So Vermeer's mother-in-law had a very difficult brother, and he came and started trying to beat up, or son, actually Katerina's brother, came and started trying to beat somebody up, and the other servant came and broke it up. And so they named her in the court document, and her name was Tanika. And I hadn't even ever heard of Tanika, but I'd already named her Annika, so I just added a T, and I thought, I'm on to something here, so it felt like I was in the right direction.
You were tapping into subliminal messaging.
I was,
amazing.
But to me, names are really, really important, and I have to get them right. So that was an instance where I felt, two instances where I felt like I got them right.
Annika, wow.
Yeah. Other questions? Oh, yes, in the front row here.
Where did you buy your socks?
Where did I buy the socks? I have two pairs of them. Two friends gave them to me, two different sets of friends, one in the States and then one got them here. So I think if you go online and just put Girl with a Pearl Earring socks, you'll probably be able to get them.
They're going to be sold out by midnight.
I think the V&A shop is going, let's bring them in.
Great question.
Any other questions? Yes, front.
When you started researching in Delft, was it complicated to get permission to consult these precious documents about the will and what it was left behind? Was there much rigmarole in accessing?
There was no rigmarole whatsoever because I didn't consult the originals. I don't speak Dutch, and I don't read old Dutch, which would have been very difficult. But luckily, someone else, John Montius, wrote an amazing biography about who he dug for 17 years through all of the archives, and he got out every little nugget of information about Vermeer. And then he wrote about it in his biography. And I used that, I bow down before him because he did all the work so that I didn't have to. Because otherwise, I would have had to spend years learning Dutch. and years. And it's not just that. Like, I speak French, but French papers from 17th century are written in a completely a different French and a different, and the handwriting. It's, you know, you could just spend, that's what academics do. And so I use the academics' work. And in fact, there was I can still visualize it. There was two pages of the will of all of the stuff listed in his house that was in Montius's biography, and I photocopied it and I taped it to the wall so that I could just see it all the time. And that was incredibly useful. But no, I always, and in the back of my books, I always put in the acknowledgments the works that I have used, and also acknowledge the people who I've stolen from, who have done so much work for me and have helped me so much.
But it's not stealing from, in a way, because academics who are extremely close to this material, who do all the paleological research and all the archival research, cannot necessarily see a picture or a narrative coming together in the sense that you were able to step back and get a sense of who this person was and what the story could be. So it's the relationship between the archivist and the fiction writer. Yeah.
When I was... in my early 30s, I started researching the Chevalier family background, and we are apparently Huguenots from the Cévennes who fled after the massacre of St. Bartholomew to Switzerland, which is where my father was born, in Moutier. And when I was there looking for through the Chevalier, trying to put together a family tree, there was a chapter in a book about Moutier that talked about the Chevaliers who first came, and the archivist there said, "Oh, I'll show you the first there were militia records, and I'll show you the mention of your ancestor, Anton Chevalier, written in 1574." So he got it out and he said, "See there," and I couldn't read it because it was just written in this way, and it was like, it didn't say Chevalier, it said Cavalier or something, and it was this bizarre French and very bizarre handwriting. So he made a photocopy of me for me of the book, of the page, and I still have it, and I look at it sometimes, and I still can't find it on the page now, even though I know it's there. I think, is it that one or that one? So there's a real art to learning not just the language, the old language, but also learning how to decipher the handwriting. Mm, mm, mm. There's a question there? Yeah.
Tracy, I'm interested in your creative writing process, particularly within an 8-month window. Were you very structured in your day and week, or how did you actually pull together both the research and the creative output?
I'm going to repeat that because I think that not everybody heard, because you want to know about my creative process and how I do it?
And the structure of your writing within a constraint of 8 months.
Of 8 months. Oh, that book. Okay, yes. Well, you know, there's nothing like a biological deadline. and that actually, I think my publisher sort of wish I had had more kids. I only had one child, and they thought, yeah, if she had had another one, then there'd be another deadline. And but I did literally found out I was pregnant on the day I started research. And I think I just thought, oh, this is going to be hard to do. I had written one novel. I knew how hard it was. And I thought, this is going to be hard to do once I have a baby. So if I can possibly get this written, that was why I made all those choices to cut it down. So I just, I researched and wrote it in a kind of dream. I wish I could tell you that I did it systematically, but you'll laugh. Like the research notebook for Girl with a Pearl Earring is the sparsest notebook ever. I don't know what happened to me, but I hardly took any notes. I took some, but not many. And now I have copious notes for all of my books. But that one, it was just, I just because there's not that much known about Vermeer, I think what I did, I started with the books that I had, which was an exhibition catalog. I looked at all the paintings really carefully. I read about them. Then I read everything I could about Vermeer. And then I read everything, I started reading everything I could about Dutch society. So you go in these concentric circles out in terms of the research. You start with the specific and then you get more and more general. And I wrote about probably about a quarter, a third of it. And then I went to Delft. Because sometimes you don't know the questions you're going to have until you have started writing. And I went to Delft, and I only spent 4 days there, but it's a small place, and I just absorbed it. I absorbed the feeling. And I also just looked at Dutch paintings every day, all the time, whether I was in Delft or at home. And then other than that, it's you have to treat writing a little bit like a job, and my editor's here, so I have to be really careful what I say. So I write every day, every single day. No, I write every... when I'm in the writing phase, the really important thing about a book is that when you're reading it, you want to feel like the writer is just ahead of you writing it, and it has this flow, like you're in sync with the writer. And in order to get that as the writer, once you start a book, you really have to keep going. So it doesn't do much good to start it and then leave it for a couple of months. So for me, it's a real commitment when I think, okay, I'm going to start writing. It's like, I'm going to start writing. It's like a marathon. I know I can't stop until I get to the finish line. And, you know, some days are better than others, but I try when I have a writing day to write 1,000 words, which is like 3 or 4 pages. And if I hit that, I feel good. If I don't hit it, I feel bad, basically. If I hit more than that, I feel like, well, you know this because you feel really virtuous. Like I've written 1,200 words instead of 1,000. And I know this sounds incredibly uncreative, but it's how you have to do it. Because if you just write when you're inspired, you'll never get it done. And
I've had other authors chastise me for saying I must hit my 1,000, because I'm the same, I'm 1,000 word a day. But I really believe in it. You set yourself a target. I try not to feel disappointed if I haven't done it, but it is a marathon, and you just, when you're in, you have to finish the book, it is just a case of getting the book out.
Yeah.
Purging it out.
yeah. And I think it's also... 1,000 words sounds like it's I've just chosen it out of the air, but I haven't. Most of the scenes I write are 3,000 or 4,000 words long. So I am in a scene for at least 3 or 4 days. And every day I feel a little bit different, so it sounds a little different. So I need 3 or 4 days to, I liken it to painting a wall. You don't just do that and that. You kind of go at it this angle and that angle with your roller, and that's what I do for a few days. And then the scene starts to get texture and life, and because I'm looking at it differently for a few days. So 1,000 words feels really good.
Mm. I'm glad you said that. We've probably got time for one more question. Is that right? One more?
Yep, there's lady here with the glasses, yes.
Thank you very much indeed. Are there any other paintings with which you felt even remotely the same kind of connection?
Oh,
great question.
Not quite the connection as with this, but I have felt the mood. There's a really wonderful painter, Danish painter called Hammershøi, who was painted at the beginning of the 20th century, and he must have studied Vermeer because there's a lot of women on their own in rooms, and they are really, the other... I'm also a really big fan of Cézanne, and I think that's because of his color palette does something to me, and there's just something so true about those colors of the apples or the men playing cards or whatever, or the landscapes, that it's like, yes, that blue, yes, that orange. I completely understand what you're doing. I feel like he and I have a mind meld in terms of the colors he uses. So I would say Cézanne, yes.
How interesting, because that's really interesting that you see the Cézanne. I've always seen the relationship color-wise between Girl with a Pearl Earring and Cézanne's palette. So isn't that interesting that you've got a sort of taste-based palette? My absolute weak at the knees one is Albrecht Dürer's Self-Portrait, just because I really, really fancy him.
Oh, yes, okay.
Sad but true. But no, those paintings that make you really connect. I mean, yeah. There was something with that painting. And it is a delight to hear that after 20 years, you're not, you haven't felt the need
As you've
to get
seen,
rid of
I can talk for England. I can bore for England about Girl of Pearl Earring, about Vermeer. I still love looking at the painting, and I still love looking at Vermeer paintings. And I think I'll always be like that.
Fantastic. Yeah. Tracy, you've inspired me. You've inspired everybody in this room. What an honour and a privilege, I think, for all of us to be here. Thank you so much. Tracy will be signing thank her you. Books after the talk. But thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to support the podcast and get better quality, loads of extras, then do please support us by going to our Patreon site, which is patreon.com/artdetective. Every single penny that you give to us will go into making better podcasts in the future. Next week, we're going behind the scenes at Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery, where I'll be talking to Pieta Greaves and Jenny Butterworth about the remaking of the Staffordshire Hoard helmet. It was an extraordinary jigsaw puzzle that's taken nearly 10 years, but it is possibly one of the most important Anglo-Saxon discoveries. So do join me in the next podcast. Thank you.